Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah!
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7am to 8:30am.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday Breakfast Show. Today is the 30th of June 2026, and thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and we've got a full house in the studio today. We've got Fiza, Juliet and Julia. Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So great to see everyone.
Yes.
We're at the end of the month.
Oh, my God.
And what a month it's been. How's everyone going this week? Any news to report?
I've been crawling to today in financial year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thanks for reminding me of another thing I need to get.
You can also donate to 3CR today. So.
Good point. Yes.
I think we're still working towards that radiothon target.
I think so, yeah. Our overall target is $300,000 for the station.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it is radiothon month.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Please, if you've got a couple of dollars, or if you can pull
chuck a fiver,
or pull some money together.
Yeah.
Anything over $2 is tax deductible.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. And if you want to say hi to us, remember our text line is always open. Fiza's in today. She loves a text message.
Send me an SMS.
Our number is 0488-809-855.
I also wanted to say, if you subscribe, you get the Cram Guide,
which
I read. I was reading. I was like, it's so cool.
Yeah,
it was really interesting. Juliet's article is awesome.
Oh, thank you.
And also, I love the Woman on the Line article too.
Yeah, both
really great.
Yeah, good plug there, Julia. the Cram Guide is great. Because like current former volunteers write articles about various aspects of the station.
Exactly.
Julia, you wrote on youth programming.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The history of youth programming at 3CR. There was some really cool stuff.
Mm.
There was a lot of school radio that was happening, which I don't think that's a thing anymore. So it was really cool to read about all that stuff and how involved the youth have been over the decades.
Mm. The youths.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I love that.
We wrote on the 40th anniversary of Women on the Line, so we looked back at Cram Guides since the 80s and tracked the history of the program and the kind of stories that they told, which was really interesting and kind of like a reflection of what was happening for women in each decade. So I think as we got close to the present day, it became a lot more like anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist.
Yeah, the evolution of it.
Which is kind of cool.
It's cool. Yeah.
Well, speaking of Radiothon and the Cram Guide and subscriptions, we are celebrating 3CR's 50th anniversary this year. And so this Saturday is the big party.
Party.
So if you haven't already heard about it, this Saturday is the 50th anniversary at the Collingwood Town Hall from 9:30. So come along if you're free. Juliet and I will be there.
Yes.
I will pop in.
Cheese will pop in.
I don't know how long, but I will pop in.
If you want to come say hi, there'll be lots of things happening, like lots of stalls
and
some performances. So lots of things to look at, to listen to. So please come down.
And also meet the faces behind the voices, which I think it's cool.
Exactly. Yeah. If you've ever wondered, what are those? What are those people on Tuesday breakfast look like?
Disembodied voices.
Yeah. come find us. And in the spirit of the 50th, first up this morning, we're going to be playing not quite archival audio, but as part of last week's Acting Up, Judith spoke to three 3CR staff members who were working at the station during the COVID outbreak. So that's Pilar, who was chair of the board, Rachel, who was manager of 3CR, and Gab, who was current affairs coordinator. And in this conversation, they reflect on COVID and how they responded to the outbreak, how they kept the station going and programs going. And yeah, it's a really interesting conversation that looks at the health response, but also the responsibility that the station had to its listeners and the broader community, which is really interesting. And then 7:30, Julie, do you want to tell us about your interview?
Yes, at 7:30 we will be interviewing Joe from the Wilderness Society about the state of forest protection in Victoria.
And then at 7:30, we're going to listen to an excerpt from a recent episode of Women on the Line, in which the team speaks to Mace, who's a women's rights organiser from the West Bank. And she talks about her experience being in prison as a result of her work for the Women's Rights Union after it was designated as a terrorist organisation. And then, yeah, she speaks as well about her volunteer work since being released from prison at a women's centre supporting women who've been incarcerated or displaced. And, yeah, this was an interview that was conducted by Tutu with translations by Malak. So, yeah, just really amazing to get to play that.
Yeah, today. That would be really great. At 8 o'clock we'll be speaking to Zoe Adema, who is part of the National Justice Project. Recently they held an action webinar about alternative first responders featuring speakers such as April Day from the Dajua Foundation, Harm Reduction Victoria, Footscray Mall Friends, Beyond Survival Project and Southside Justice. So we'll be reflecting on that and talking about what people can do to advocate for alternative first responders in the lead up to the state election.
And finally, at 8:15, we'll be speaking to Casey, an organiser with Students Against War, about the Close Pine Gap rally this Saturday on July 4th outside the Defence Plaza at 1:30 p.m., bringing attention to Pine Gap, which listeners tuned in last week would have heard about, the upcoming convergence in July taking place on stolen Arante lands.
Great. So it's going to be a big show for us this morning, so stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines in a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, who?
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 30th of June, 2026. A series of high-profile and punitive law changes have directly fueled a sharp rise in Indigenous incarceration in Victoria, with corrections data showing Aboriginal imprisonment has increased by almost a quarter over the past year. Corrections Victoria figures for the end of May show 1,094 First Nations people in prison, 209 more than at the same time in 2025. The increase was particularly stark for Aboriginal women, whose imprisonment rate rose 85.1% over the year. Almost half of all Aboriginal people in custody, 530 people, are on remand awaiting trial, following the introduction of new bail laws the Victorian government has described as the toughest in the country. The data clearly shows, according to the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, a government that has put politics ahead of basic human rights. VALS Chief Executive Narita Waite said VALS and other legal and human rights organisations had repeatedly warned the government that the bail and sentencing reforms introduced in two stages over the past 2 years amid heightened public concern about crime, would disproportionately harm Aboriginal communities. The Victorian government can no longer claim that the harm caused by their policies and investments are unintended consequences, when it is clear the outcome will be the mass incarceration of our people.
The death toll from, in other news, the death toll from Venezuela's twin earthquakes has risen to at least 1,450 as rescue workers struggle to save lives after a critical window for locating survivors closed. The National Assembly President Jorge Rodriguez shared the updated death toll on Sunday, saying at least 3,150 people were injured in the back-to-back magnitude 7.2 and 7.5 on the Richter scale earthquakes that hit near the coastal area of La Guaira on Wednesday. He said 12,721 people have been displaced and 774 buildings have collapsed. Just under 50,000 people have been reported missing, and about 30,000 Venezuelan rescue workers and 2,700 foreign rescue experts have been searching for survivors. The critical 72-hour window for rescuing trapped victims after a national disaster passed late on Saturday. However, a handful of rescues on Sunday offered glimmers of hope. Reporting from Katia Lamar in La Guaira, Al Jazeera's Teresa Bohr described the disaster as a big test for the government of Rodriguez, who assumed the presidency after the US military's abduction of President Nicolas Maduro in January. Delcy Rodriguez has pledged to be an agent of change in a country that has long contended with overlapping economic and humanitarian crises. She has cooperated closely with the US President Donald Trump's administration.
Also in the news, protesters have taken to the streets of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to express their anger at the United States' brokered framework agreement between the governments of Lebanon and Israel on Friday, following months of direct negotiations. Many of the demonstrators waved flags of the Iran-backed group Hezbollah, which has been militarily confronting Israel's ongoing invasion and occupation of large swaths of southern Lebanon. Israel and Hezbollah have been fighting since October 2023 with varying levels of intensity, but the former has twice escalated the conflict, first in September 2024 and then nearly 4 months ago. Some of the harshest critics of the framework, which does not force the Israeli army to withdraw from the area it occupies, have been those most deeply impacted by Israel's war, which has killed more than 4,200 people and forced hundreds of thousands from their homes since early March. Ali Zaitoun, a resident of Beirut's southern suburbs known as Dahiyeh, said, "After everything my family, my village, the south, and Dahiyeh have endured, the destruction, the displacement, the grief and the loss, it is incredibly difficult for me to accept an agreement with the same state that carried out the military actions that devastated our communities." Finally, in the headlines, a labour saga in Singapore involving migrant workers going unpaid for months after a contractor fled the country has raised questions about wage policies for so-called unskilled staff. Last week, hundreds of migrant workers in services such as air conditioning, plumbing and construction showed up at the Ministry of Manpower building in a rare labour confrontation in the city-state. On Sunday, the Minister of State for Manpower, Dinesh Vasudash, said the employer in question, Ramu Palanivelu, a Singapore permanent resident and director of KPA Engineering, SK Industries and VVR Plant Engineering, had returned to Singapore and was helping with investigations. His passport has been impounded. However, long before the crisis escalated, the Ministry of Manpower was already alerted about salary issues from KPA Engineering. The company has a history of not paying their workers properly. Across 2025 and 2026, Singaporean NGO Transient Workers Count helps 6 workers from the company file salary claims against the company. TWC pointed out that the burden of wage theft should not fall on workers who have to struggle to prove their claims, often while navigating debt, family obligations, and a foreign environment. Instead, a centralized wage protection scheme should allow the authorities to automatically detect when employers fail to pay their workers on time. These have been the news headline for Tuesday, 30th of June, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and if you've just tuned in, we were just going through the news headlines for today. As part of 3CR's 50th anniversary, we've been sharing archival audio from 3CR programs throughout the decades. This morning, we're starting with an excerpt from Acting Up from the 20th of June, during which presenter and former breakfast host Judith reflected on COVID-19 and the challenges faced by 3CR, its staff and volunteers in response to the pandemic. In the following excerpt, we hear from Pilar, who was chair of 3CR board, Rachel, who was manager of 3CR, and Gab, who was the current affairs coordinator during this time. Here's Judith.
Do you remember where you were when you first got the news about the coronavirus outbreak in Victoria?
Probably at home.
I was actually coming back from the funeral of a dear friend of mine's mother, and we wondered, while sitting on the outskirts of Melbourne, whether we'd be allowed back into the city. So I remember it really well.
Do you remember it, Rachel?
I do. I was on the couch with my kids watching the news and thinking, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it actually happened really quickly, as we'll all remember.
Yeah, it did. And how did you feel about it? Like, did you have any idea, any of you, what was coming?
No, definitely not. It was really, I think, naively, I thought, oh, this is only going to be 4 weeks, 6 weeks at the most. Little did we know.
You were just out of your Invasion Day broadcast. And you suddenly had to start doing things. So what was at the top of your mind?
We took very seriously the potential of harm to our community. And we had very thoughtful conversations at both staff level and committee level to really identify what the different needs were in our community, because obviously they're not homogenous. I don't know if we'd really gotten to the nuance of it early on. I think that came later on. But really thinking through, I think at the forefront of our decision was the harm that might be caused by the transmission of something that was still so unknown. But what we did know was that it was rapidly moving, and that those that could harm the most were the vulnerable. And we were really keenly aware that almost every identified vulnerable group at the time that the state government or federal government had been identifying had a program at 3CR. Every group that has been identified coming into our station weekly, monthly, and they're the ones that we need to be making our decisions for.
What did you have to put in place for the broadcasters to continue their work if they could?
My memory is that we acted very quickly, as Rachel said. So we locked down the station, sent out information, and we did a full lockdown from the 19th of March 2020.
Which was, from memory, at least a couple of weeks before lockdowns actually became mandated by state government, which in some ways gave us a small jump, because we had already been grappling with, well, what does it mean to shut down a community radio station that's predominantly live? What on earth does that mean?
The other thing to remember is during that time, we didn't know whether it was aerosol or contact. It was all about touching and hand sanitizing and before the social distancing around aerosol. So studios are airtight spaces. So straight away, we were only allowing one person in the studio. We were already thinking about that. The experts still hadn't decided whether it was aerosol or contact. We just planned for both, really.
You had a responsibility to inform the community, but how were you going to keep broadcasting when people couldn't even come into the studio? What did you do about that?
When I think back to that challenge, I actually remember it really fondly. It was really hard. We were really tasked with a proper good problem.
And I really enjoyed how we work together as a community to solve those problems. We have a fantastic staff team, a fantastic crew of volunteers and supporters from the community, and supported at all times by a really great committee of management. So we had some really great people on these problems, and we kind of rethought, well, what do we want to do? We want to keep broadcasting. Mm. We want to keep people engaged. People were... If you'll remember, people were panicking. People were isolated and isolating from each other. So that real need still for connection and care and participation was still really, you know, these were really things people wanted and needed. Yeah. So we've, by hook or by crook, figured out ways to make that happen. And we figured out how to make the studios work for us. We set up really simple file transfer protocols, allowing people to upload things. We rejigged our website to allow people to both share content, upload content, and for us to broadcast that content. But I think really what we did is we just kind of thought about, well, what do we want to do? And then we figured out how to make that happen. And I say I remember that fondly because I actually remember sitting at my desk and having people from our community call to speak to me and say things like, I've got a spare $2,000. I'm going to put it in your bank account. You make sure that that person and the name of person who supports a program has got a laptop because I know they don't have one. Or I've got 4 computers that I can go and get from work. You tell me where I need to drop those off to. Oh. And that's literally how we got technology into some of our communities' homes. Yeah. Well, actually, we stripped the studios too, didn't we? Every computer that was not required for a broadcast pathway we had at that time was removed from the station, tagged, and then made sure it was in the home of someone who needed it. So that was one part of the problem, putting the actual tools there, but then teaching me. I feel like part of my thing at that time was making sure resources got to where they got to go, but then how do we do all of that and how do we keep broadcast quality up? That was more.
Yeah, I wondered about the training and how you managed it.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Memory's kind to you too, isn't it? Because actually, I think I kind of remember it fondly, but I'm sure I was pulling my hair out at the time. Again, remembering just the misinformation and the lack of information. So we just had to hit the ground running, as well as researching what it was and what the potentials were to keep our community safe, plus looking for technology to keep people connected. As Rachel mentioned in the beginning, our community here, not everyone had a laptop. People are living in shared housing with no wireless connection. So we were getting dongles and, you know, as Rachel said, people were generously donating money for us to put prepaid on that. People were using mobile phones. We were getting that people with a headphone jack. Our technicians were making cords that fit into different people's phones. We all, steep learning curve, we were training people out the back. You know, our building, if you've been to 3CR, is, you know, a small building in around the high rise now of Fitzroy. So we're in the back alley socially distancing, but teaching people how to log into Zoom and, you know, like, and with passwords and accounts. And it was a busy time, and we're only in the there's only a few of us in the station at the time.
Yeah, I was wondering who was allowed to be in the station.
Well, as a media outlet, we were one of the exempt industries, so all of our staff could work in the station. Mm-hmm. But it required a huge amount of bureaucracy, which I had to manage. There was, I don't know if anyone remembers, but you had to submit forms. There was this, there was that. You had to get that, you had to get this. It was just like add it to the list of chores to do at the time. But I think we did, wouldn't you say, Gab? We tried really hard to responsibly use the station as well, though. We had room limits well and truly, like Gab said, and I do actually credit you with a lot of the research that you took on. We had isopropyl in the studios long before people said, oh, you should be using that. Like, you remember?
Yeah, I went deep diving into some of the kind of existing medical information from SARS. And the isopropyl alcohol and the air filters were the two things that were really important. So we got onto that very quickly, and, you know, Rachel was onto it quick, smart. We got, as she said, the last container of isopropyl alcohol in Melbourne, we think. Mm. And plus we got the air filters sorted, made in, and we wanted them to be made in Australia. We weren't going to throw out our ethical stance on other things just with all the rubbish that was coming through. So we wanted to actually buy proper ethicals, you know, we wanted to source it ethically if we could, and air filters and things like that, that in the future would be easily replaceable and not too much cost burden on the station.
Which I'm pleased to see, beautiful HIPAA filter down there is still here.
Still going.
Oh, yes.
We researched drum replacements, all those things that Gab said, because I think you've just kind of jogged a memory to how many almost parasitical products and marketing popped up around that time.
Definitely.
And there was a lot of money being wasted by big organisations and even the state government, really, on, you know, let's buy the... You remember Samsung filters? They were being shipped over here by the dozen, and they lasted like 6 weeks. But at the same time, just to go somewhere else with it, I also remember that there was a very real lack of any health messaging done in community language at that time. And our credible community broadcast languages took that on for their communities, went to health briefings, and then translated that information. They really did the hard yards without any government support.
Exactly. And I actually, that brought a memory of the towers in Flemington that were in deep, deep lockdown midway through that first year. The majority of the community there spoke Arabic, but there were also members of the community, my friend's dad being one of them, who spoke Spanish. And I remember having to translate some of that messaging into Spanish because the government hadn't considered that some of the community there spoke Spanish. And in fact, he was on our one of our Spanish language programs at the time, speaking during that crazy towers that were in lockdown. 3CR became really important in terms of that messaging to the communities. Once again, radio showing how important it is. And without all that government funding, because they were recording messages, you know, government-funded messages, but not in enough languages. So,
yeah, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I was going to mention the community language programs and, you know, how you kept those on air, because they're usually a live program, and to keep those going, especially since they were so important.
I think that actually the technology and the systems we set up, they were the same for everybody.
Yeah.
So really it was just making sure they had access to the things they needed to produce the shows in a way that could be sent to us. But I'd also say they were very proactive in making sure that their program went to air. I remember long after even the real intensity of it, shows like Eritrean Voices having a doctor's segment on their show every week. There was so much disinformation in their community about what the causes of COVID were, whether or not the vaccine was going to harm you.
I'd add too, in terms of technology, they're actually a great source of inspiration for us, because what people need to realise is that community languages have been doing really interesting lo-fi technological hookups way longer than some of the other English-speaking programs, because of time difference and regional distances. They've worked out how to record holding their phones up to speakers. You know, the sound quality's never been great, but they were actually, you know, ahead of their time. And they land, as well as what Rachel was saying, in terms of their community information and the role they play, their technological know-how was also really helpful to other programmers too. I was ringing them going, you know that recording you did on the phone, how'd you do it?
You're listening to 3CR, and that was Judith from 3CR's Acting Up, speaking to Pilar, Rachel and Gab, who were all on 3CR staff during the outbreak of COVID-19 in 2020. And just towards the end of that interview, Gab was talking about community language programs and how they were in many ways technologically more advanced than the English speaking programs, and were teaching other programs a lot during that time. It's a great conversation. So if you'd like to listen to the full episode, you can go to 3cr.org.au/acting up. We're going to go to a track now. This is part of today's theme, which is looking at songs from 2020. Back in 2020, Gamila Ray, singer-songwriter and musician Thelma Plum, released a cover of Powderfinger's song These Days. Here it is.
It's coming round again, slowly creeping ahead of time and its command. Soon enough it comes and settles in its place, shadow in my face, but it's pressure in my day. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days stand out nothing like I had planned. Control, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days stand out nothing like I had planned. It's coming round again, slowly creeping ahead. Time and its command. It shadows in its place. Its shadow in my face puts pressure on my day. Soon enough it comes. Here it is again. Slowly creeping in. Time and its command. Soon enough it comes. Settles in its place. A shadow in my face, undignified and lame. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days turned out nothing like I had planned. Control, well, it's slipping right through.
Jo is a campaign manager from the Wilderness Society with deep experience in forests and campaigning against logging in Victoria. She's also part of the Nature Alliance Victorians for Nature, which report on the protection of our forests that are becoming dismantled due to loopholes found by logging businesses. Today, she's joining us on the show to discuss with us the state of forests in Vic and how we can act for better nature protection. Hi, Jo. How's it going?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Julia.
No worries. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
You're welcome.
So, can you tell me about forests and the importance of their ecosystems, as well as a bit of their history on a wider scope?
Yeah, look, forests are really important and essential for all life support systems on our planet, essentially. They absorb carbon dioxide, that is the main driver of climate change, and they breathe out oxygen, which obviously people need to survive. They are also home to about 80% of the world's land-based species. But here in Victoria, our forests play a really direct role in the health of our water catchments and the quality of our drinking water. So in Melbourne, in particular, we're quite famous for our clean drinking water. So, you know, they're really important for the general state of our environment, but also for our personal health and well-being.
Yeah, exactly. They have such a wide impact and affect every part of our lives. So I guess my question is, who are the companies that are threatening to destroy these forests and why?
Look, you know, in Victoria, native forest logging officially ended on the 1st of January 2024. And so, you know, that was a really great moment and win for the environment, you know, movement in Victoria that had been campaigning to stop native forest logging in Victoria for a very long time. However, it hasn't actually stopped, and it has taken a different form, I suppose. So in terms of companies, the continued logging is not due to a lack of alternatives, because plantation timber in Victoria already supplies most of our construction needs. but it's rather a persistence of structures within the timber industry, I suppose, contracts, but more importantly, policy decisions made by government to keep native forest logging in some sense supported politically. So the issue is less about individual companies acting alone, but more about the system and forestry operations, government agencies, which really, you know, enable logging to take place in forests under a different guise now. So it's not commercial logging, so to speak. It's probably taking place more under the guise of forest fire management and a safety element, which is completely hard to swallow when we're talking about cutting down the magnificent mountain ash in our central highlands areas that are hundreds of years old. And these forests actually are home to some of our most unusual, beautiful and threatened species.
I think a lot of what I've been hearing as well, that there's been a lot of loopholes found by these logging businesses. So it seems that, like, yeah, that there needs to be some stronger policies from the government. Do you think that that's a possibility?
Oh, absolutely, it's a possibility. But it really, really needs people, the power of people to speak up about this. Policy change is, you know, really at the will of governments, and governments listen to the people who vote for them. So when we talk about logging loopholes, it's really simple. It's a simple kind of question of just changing legislation. So I'll give you an example. When native forest logging stopped officially on the 1st of January 2024, there's a whole lot of beautiful forest in Victoria that land tenure remains as something called state forest. And the legislation around state forests enables things, extractive activities to happen in state forests, such as logging. So what we're asking for is the government stopped native forest logging. So let's change that land tenure of state forests in Victoria to a higher level of protection so that those forests are permanently protected, and so that if there is a change of will or a change of government, that that is a very hard decision to overturn, and that those forests should actually be protected for future generations to come.
Yeah, exactly. It's extremely important, especially with what we're seeing now in Lutruwita, Tasmania, where there are a lot of forests there aren't being protected because of, poor nature laws. So...
That's right.
I know we weren't going to mention, well, because of the word, but I know that you're working with a campaign, which we'll call the Duckery campaign instead of the F word. So could you tell us a little bit more about this campaign?
Look, there's a growing level of concern amongst environmental groups in Victoria, but also just... supporters of the environmental groups that have got together, including the Wilderness Society and other organisations like the Victorian National Parks Association, the Victorian Forest Alliance, and all the members of that alliance, and Environment Victoria, who have got together to call the government out on a lot of the duckery that's going on in Victoria. The campaign is to stop the duckery, so to speak, and it's a public accountability campaign run by this alliance of environment NGOs, and we call ourselves Victorians for Nature. You can check it out on the website at victoriansfornature.au. And we're really looking at ramping up our campaign towards the, you know, the election that's happening in Victoria in November, but the campaign will run well beyond that to you know, at least 2030. And the campaign documents and names very bluntly and directly and on purpose the loopholes, the backflips, the funding cuts and the broken commitments that are quietly undoing Victoria's nature protection across all sorts of things, including forests, fishery, fauna protection, funding of the environment and feral species. So the campaign gives Victorians a way to see what is happening in this state, make some noise about it and put pressure on the politicians who can actually fix it and make the issue of nature protection and the environment more visible in the lead up to November. So it just becomes harder to ignore.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm really glad that that campaign is happening. And yes, listeners, for listeners who are interested, I'll definitely link more information about the campaign on our podcast notes. Yes, so yeah, well, thank you for sharing this with us, Jo. I think that might be all we have time for today.
Yeah, no worries. If people want to get involved, like absolutely go to the website and there's lots of things you can do to get involved in support, including contact your local MP and, you know, just let them know that you're concerned about what's happening with the state of the environment in Victoria at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll also link anywhere that people can donate. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing with us today, Jo. Yeah, it's a really
welcome.
Important message, and thank you.
Yeah, before we go, happy birthday to 3CR.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a nice little coincidence that the Wilderness Society is also turning 50 this year. So 1976 was a big year.
Wow, oh, there you go. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great. Oh, cool. Thank you.
No worries. See you, Julia.
See you. We've been speaking with Jo, a campaign manager for Victoria at the Wilderness Society, to donate in protest against logging, against the forest. We will put a link to their website where you can donate and find out more. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast.
We're going to go to another song now. This is also from 2020. So this is by Alex the Astronaut, who is a folk pop singer-songwriter. In 2020, they released the album The Theory of Absolutely Nothing, and this song is their second track on the album. It's called Lost.
It's all the same as it was last night. Morning hits her in the face, cold wind. Someone is growing inside of the feeling of fear spreads through her mind. A positive sign on a stick made of plastic, hides it in a drawer by a bed. Makes her way down to the door, grabs a bag. Mum and dad ask, is she alright? Oh no, the smile is fake. She's gonna tell him spoke to your parents, no, so the boy and the girl sat at school alone. He asked, what's inside her? Will it know? If you take the pill, 1, 2, 3, breathe slowly, everything's fine. Tries to be like the men he's seen online. Make a joke, smile, say, it's all right. She laughs, he knows that it's fake. They know that.
Spin.
slept yet. Visions of a child like her that haven't stopped yet. She'd usually cry, she'd usually call him, but she doesn't feel like calling. He sits alone at home with the door closed, thinking it over alone with the door closed. There's tears in his eyes, the secret he's held catches up.
You're listening to 3CR, and that was Lost by Alex the Astronaut. And next up, we're going to listen to an excerpt of a recent episode of Women on the Line, produced by Scheherazade, who this clip interviews Mace, who's a women's rights organizer from the West Bank. At the start of the Israeli occupation in October 2023, Mace's women's rights union was designated as a terrorist organization. As a result, the Israeli government imprisoned Mace at Al Damon. Mace has since been released and has been volunteering at a women's center supporting women who've been incarcerated and others who have been displaced. And at the centre, they train the women in embroidery skills to help with their own economic independence. And in this clip, Mais provides a testimony to her experience and that of her friends and speaks about her involvement with the Women's Centre since her release. And this interview was conducted by Tutu with translations by Malak. Here is that clip.
مرحبا اسمي مايس أسيرة محررة من نابلس فلسطين.
Her name is Mais. She's an ex-prisoner.
أنا تعرضت للاعتقال.
She was imprisoned 3 times. The first time she's mainly from Hebron, so she was studying at Hebron schools. But the first time they arrested her with some other group of girls and boys at that time at El Mascovia area. And at that time, she says that the administrative occupation was not very harsh like these days. At that time, they take you for administrative period. If they cannot prove any accusation, any guilt you have committed, they will release you. Mm-hmm. So she was occupied for Shaharian for 2 months only. And then she was released with other girls and boys because they couldn't accuse her with anything officially.
And this time?
في كمان مرة وأنا أول ما تزوجت 89 مرة.
The second time, the first time she was still single in Hebron. The second time she was newly married and pregnant with her first daughter. And they took her from the place of her work, the union for Union Committee for Women. For Palestinian women, she was working there, and they were arresting her from there. And they stayed in Nablus prison for how long?
Only one week.
They arrested her for 1 week, and they couldn't also approve something against her, so she was released.
What happened with your daughter in this week?
She was pregnant in her 7th month at that time, and she got really extremely sick. While she was arrested, and throwing up and all these stomach diseases. So at that time, she says, not because they are so good, but because they don't have time for sick women, they gave me some medicine to stop that illness in her stomach and the throwing up all the time, because they don't have time to deal with sick women. That's the only reason they gave her treatment. But they were hitting and at that time. They didn't recognize, they didn't respect that she's a pregnant woman. So they hit them, but when they saw that she's completely sick, they stopped and they gave her treatment.
Did she see a doctor or just...
They just gave her some medicine with painkillers and that's it.
And this time?
No, very difficult.
Mm.
Well, this time was really the most difficult one because of the war, because of the situation of the country, because all of these accusations about if you maybe put a post on Facebook talking about this, the Palestinian situation, they will accuse you that you are trying to make troubles or you are trying to make the public opinion against the occupation, so they will arrest you immediately. So she was expecting that this is the reason why they took her. And she was expecting that she is going to stay in the prison from 5 months to a year, because these accusations take this long with mm-hmm. the occupation laws. So at that time when they knocked on her door, she realized that she's going to be in a very difficult situation because of the war. And you know, after the war, they became even more savages. They treated people more and more harm. They all the time. Making it very hard and difficult for the prisoners. So after this, she was cuffed and blinded her eyes and put her inside the jeep. She started to think, okay, how I'm going to survive now? I'm not going to think about anything, but how to survive and to pass this period and this stage mm-hmm. of her life.
You were focused on survival and you couldn't think of your family that yes. was... behind you.
It doesn't mean that she forgot everything about her family, always in her mind. No one forgets his family. Mm. But at that stage, you only think, how am I going to survive? I am in a very, very difficult now situation. The family is out. They can manage. But I am the one who is in, and I have to stay strong to survive, to confront, because if they feel that you are weak and you are surrendering, they will use this against you. So you need to stay strong and to face the accusations to defend yourself and to survive inside the prison.
It's very strong.
Yeah, we saw her family situation after she was arrested. Yeah, Wael and her son, because she has one son and the other are daughters like me. So her son was so, you know, when Wael, her husband, was telling us the story, me and Atta, we started to weep, because I remembered as well, because I have one son and he's so attached to me, yes. like her son is attached to her, you know? Mm. Always the one son so attached to his mother. So Wael was telling us what her son was doing. He refused to hug her, because he was denying that she's leaving. So he was in a very bad situation, and me and Atta, we started to weep and to cry, because we couldn't, they tried to look so strong in front of her so she would not be collapsing. They just asked her, just take care of yourself and be strong, we will be fine. So it was really very bad situation. It's not easy for any, especially the mother, you know.
Yes.
The mother is always the one who is all the house standing on, even the husband. Mm. Even if you see the husband very strong, the mother is the one who is behind all this. So if they took they take the mother, and you will feel that all the house collapse. It's not easy, the mother absence. Yani. So it was a very difficult situation for her and also for the family, but she couldn't show them this for the occupation. Because they will use her weakness against her, you know?
Yes. And this is happening to mothers in Palestine.
Yes,
there is.
And she was trying to make it easier to her and herself. She was saying, okay, at least my kids are grown ups, they can take care of themselves. Mm. Although we are so attached to each other, but when she saw other cases like mothers who has newborns, who were breastfeeding maybe, or whose kids are 5 years old, 6 years old, all the time crying, wants their mothers. She feels that there are even more difficult cases than her case.
And your friends, some of them are still experiencing this.
Yes, yes.
One of her friends who is now still in prison, also the father is in prison. So it's an only child, and now she is with her aunt. Mm. After her mother's arrested and also her father arrested, now she is with her aunt, and she has now a difficult case, because even before she has difficulty in speaking and in expressing herself. Now this is even much harder, because even when she expresses, she's more violent. Mm. She started to be more violent. She cannot. After she was in prison, they closed. After when she was in prison, of course, they closed the association where she used to work because they considered it a terrorist organization. I told you yesterday about it. So she felt that she's now worthless. She used to work like for 40 years. She was working since she was 20 and now she's 60. So 40 years in field work and then find her unemployed. Other associations didn't receive her in their places because anyone who has in his CV anything related to occupation and to political stuff, they don't accept him in other associations. No support for these people. So in the Women's Support Center, they afford her to become a volunteer into Rathiyat project for women from Gaza, for imprisoned women, for women who have talent and has no income or who are leading families. They started this project to help them financially and psychologically as well. And the Women's Support Center asked her to be a volunteer to be controlling this project and to be the advisor of this project, and she agreed because she finally felt that it's a very good chance to feel that I'm doing something in my life, you see. And she had a library in her neighborhood, and at that library she started to sell things for like stationery for children, and now she feels a little bit that she's alive because it's not easy to be independent woman for this long life, long years, and now you need to take money from your kids or from your husband. It's not easy. So now yani it's more even better situation for her. And by the way, the Turathiyat, a project that Mais is talking about, is a very important project. As I told you before, it was like an idea for when we saw Gaza women working like very beautiful, intelligent handcrafts, you know, and we were thinking, why not to help these women to make their own project instead of waiting for someone to help them? So this is where the idea started from. So we as a center, we started to think about how to help these women and to live in dignity at the same time and to do a project in our center. So we invited these women, we gave them a little bit training, and we announced that some other women, they can come, ex-prisoners, maybe families of prisoners who has women who can do such things, and also families who led by women, who has no men to finance or to do the expenses. So we targeted all these groups of women in the center, and we try to help them with some stuff and with some training.
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
We've been listening to a translated interview in which Mais, a women's rights organizer, shared her experience of being imprisoned in the West Bank by the occupation forces, as well as the experience of her friend also in prison. And she also discussed her recent volunteer work with a women's center where women are taught embroidery skills. This episode originally aired on Women on the Line on Monday, 15th of June, produced by Scheherazade. And up next, we're going to play a song by Maisha, who's a strong, proud Anangu / Torres Strait Islander woman who released her debut collections of songs entitled Nayaringu in 2020. And this song is called Hold Strong.
And if you write it, or if you don't, I forgave all of my goals. The end of a war is already broke before it makes sure. The history that nothing that could ever
while I can fight. Nobody gonna teach me how to spend your time. It pushes and pulls. Aren't you like surrender? This was after the fight.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yoda Yoda, Dja Dja Rong, Kalkadin, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au. And if you've just tuned in, we were just playing the song Hold Strong by Maisha. We are now joined on the line by Zoe Ademar, who is part of the National Justice Project, working on the Alternative First Responders campaign as campaign content creator, advocate, and copywriter. Zoe is a passionate and highly accomplished creative producer, artist, writer, and advocate for community-led change. Zoe brings over 10 years of experience at the intersection of storytelling, social justice, and strategic engagement, driving transformative public art projects and campaigns across so-called Australia. She joins us this morning to reflect on the National Justice Project's recent action webinar that featured a lineup of speakers calling for community care over policing and criminalisation. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Zoe.
Hi, Fung. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us on the program this morning. Like I said in my introduction, National Justice Project recently held an action webinar featuring speakers such as April Day from the Dajua Foundation, Harm Reduction Victoria, Beyond Survival, Southside Justice, and Footscray Moore Friends. And one of the first things that I wanted to ask you about was the importance of centering First Nations knowledge, lived experience, and solutions. Something that many of the speakers spoke of, especially April Day, was the fact that the issues that we have of policing, state-sanctioned violence, and harm have existed on this continent since invasion and have stemmed from ongoing impacts of colonization. So I was wondering if you could reflect on the importance of First Nations led solutions.
Absolutely. And before I begin, I want to acknowledge that I am dialing in from the unceded sovereign land of the Gadigal people and pay my respects to elders past and present. Thank you for this question. I think it's a really important place to start. And as April Day said at the Alternative First Responders webinar, it's the advocacy of First Nations families and the history of resilience and lived experience of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities that has to ground and guide the conversation and implementation of alternatives to policing. And that's because First Nations communities deeply understand the harms caused by policing and deeply understand what true safety means and how to care for each other in the face of systemic racism and harm. And true safety means care, it means dignity, community, and being met with support instead of punishment. And First Nations communities have been caring for one another in this way for thousands of years. And so we must listen to this knowledge if we want to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. And a really clear example of this is the public intoxication reform in Victoria. As a result of the Day's family advocacy and knowledge, which was absolutely central in getting that reform across the line and ensuring that people are met with care and not criminalisation. Mm-hmm. And what makes that so powerful is that it is Indigenous governed. It's genuinely co-designed with the communities it serves. And First Nations knowledge wasn't an add-on or an afterthought. It was the foundation and the driving force that allowed the reforms to fully detach from the colonial law enforcement that we see today and prevent any further expansion of policing powers in that space. And so now the public intoxication reform is a statewide ecosystem of care. It's a network of sobering up centres, outreach teams, transportation, a 24/7 phone line that is accessible to anyone through 000, and really demonstrates how First Nations family-led reform has changed the landscape for everyone and shows us what's possible when governments actually trust Aboriginal community-controlled organisations and First Nations families and peer workers to lead and support that leadership through sustainable long-term funding that ensures that community-led services can provide the care they know their community needs.
Thanks for that, Zoe. And yeah, one of the programs that April mentioned during her address was Ngungwala. And as a resident of St Kilda, I've seen firsthand the work that they've done for First Nations people in that area. And I know that we'll be speaking a bit more about that and other programs a bit later on. But I guess this leads me to my next question. And this is something that you've sort of already answered in your first response, but it's the fact that communities already have the solutions to a lot of these issues. And this was mentioned by all speakers. So it's not that the grassroots organisations that are out there don't have the answers. They do. What is missing is the resourcing and the funding of programs to formalise, to scale and sustain programs. And, you know, I'm thinking of that pie chart that was projected by Harm Reduction Victoria, where they showed how little funding they were getting to support, you know, harm minimisation and things like that. So I was wondering if you could talk about this in a bit more detail.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree with you. You know, community knowledge and communities are the experts in these situations. And I think it was really clear in the webinar that the issue really is no longer whether alternatives work, it's whether governments are willing to listen and willing to invest boldly. And as you mentioned during the webinar, Harm Reduction Victoria really illustrated this funding gap, and they referenced a report by the Drug Policy Modelling Program at University of New South Wales, which revealed this staggering imbalance. 65% or $3.5 billion of Australia's national drug strategy budget is directed towards prisons and policing, while only 1.6% is allocated to harm reduction. Despite this being, you know, the most evidence-based solution we have to minimising harm and keeping people safe. And unfortunately, this spending pattern occurs across the board. And when you look at government investment in community-led services against funding for police and prisons, the imbalance is really impossible to ignore. And so, you know, we're at this critical point for action with the election coming up. We really do need to urge governments to move away from punishment over care spending. And we don't want to see this continuous funding of prisons and law enforcement and see that continue to outweigh the funding that to community-led services and programs that are actually saving lives. And that's a really huge failure of government. We know that these systems create harm and trauma, while peer support workers and volunteers and community services and frontline workers, many of whom do this work unpaid, are the ones who are actually keeping people safe, connected and alive. So we really need to see governments back responses that are genuinely keeping people safe. And I want to give a quick shout out to MP David Edishank from the Legalised Cannabis Party, who attended the Alternative First Responder webinar and brought the case for alternative first responders to Parliament, naming this dangerous over-reliance on police in Melbourne as a result of chronic underfunding of critical services. So, we absolutely need long-term and flexible funding that allows community-led services to deliver care and provide care in a myriad of ways, including prevention, outreach teams, transport services, support lines that are available 24/7. And we need funding that reflects this new way of working, and that's bold investment in community-led models of care.
Mm. Yeah, and that's something that we've talked about on 3CR before, is funding not only these community programs, but also things like public housing and public health, which we're seeing sort of crumble before us. I wanted to pivot slightly and talk about the importance of language. I think it was Lauren from Beyond Survival who spoke about the fact that the police are often using language of first responders to minimize or dilute the harms that they themselves can perpetrate. And so, Zoe, why is it so important to expose and speak plainly about the police?
Such an interesting part of the webinar, and something that I've been really reflecting on since. And as you mentioned, one of the speakers, Lauren Caulfield from Beyond Survival Project, which is a for and by project led by survivors of family violence, recently published In the Name of Safety report alongside Flat Out and RMIT. And Lauren really spoke to this narrative battle that's occurring where police are co-opting the language of first responders, even though we know many people, especially those in intimate partner or family violence situations, do not feel safe calling the police for support. And again, it's these frontline community services, key workers, friends and families who are actually providing the safety nets and the support needed. And so we must recognise this and see it as the important entry to support that they are. Yet, we see police-led responses continue to be centred in policy and in the conversation about community safety. So the Harm in the Name of Safety report names the repeated harms in police-led responses, especially to family violence, and that included findings that 90% of frontline workers said that they had witnessed bias and discrimination in police responses to family violence, and 83% saying they witnessed police misidentify the perpetrator in intimate partner violence situations. So something needs to change, and we need to be able to name these harms plainly so that we can build and fund safety nets that ensure all people have access to the support and care they need in situations of distress.
Yeah, and something else that was discussed during this part of the webinar was the fact that a lot of the times when you know, there is a complaint made against the police, it's the police who are investigating themselves. So I think that's, yeah, another reason why speaking so plainly about the harms caused by police is so important. You alluded to this before, but I was hoping we could speak about this in a bit more detail. So there is a state election coming up in Victoria, and I know that there's a huge campaign to get people to advocate for alternative first responders. So what resources has the National Justice Project made available to help people write to their MPs and to make their letters and their emails as effective as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. We would love for people to engage in the political process and write letters of advocacy to your local MPs calling for alternatives to police. We have a number of templates available on our website, including a mountain of free resources to support your advocacy. Our position paper is up there, as well as a number of other research reports to help your knowledge and to get further informed. And I think the main thing is to keep it personal and to tap into why this is important to you and why alternative responders is important to your community. When you make it personal, that's when politicians really listen. But yeah, if you hop over to our website, alternativefirstresponders.com.au, you'll find all of the templates and support needed to engage in that advocacy process.
Thank you so much for that, Zoe, and something that I really appreciated while I was watching the Action webinar recording was that, you know, Chloe left time for people to write during the session, put on some really nice sort of calming music, and it was really nice knowing that there were people sort of on a online call together but working sort of individually on their letters but could pipe up if they had questions. So maybe that's an idea for people if they want to get a group of friends together to do some letter writing together. But finally, for my last question today, I think relationships and care were at the core of each group's presentations. So as I said before, I'm thinking about April's comments on Ngungwala and how they take people home and cook for them, or Footscray Mall Friends who meet people, help them with documents, appointments, or Southside Justice who work very closely with Vixen. So just a closing statement about the importance of relationships and care when talking about alternative first responders.
And there was so much evidence and stories of incredible community-led responses and how these are rooted in care and dignity and make such a huge ripple impact in the way that one person understands that they are cared for, that they matter, that people are looking out for them, and how that ripples outward and impacts their community and indeed crosses over into policy as well. And Footscray Mall Friends, who you spoke about and who also spoke at the webinar, are doing such powerful work in the way that they're showing up for their communities and taking the time to actually listen and get to know people in their community who might be doing it tough right now. And through this relational way of connecting, they're able to build the trust that that is required and that is needed when people need to reach out to different services or supports. And this is kind of preventative care in action, and it's exactly the kind of approach that we need to be investing in. It's transformational and life-saving work that is also, you know, reflected in the work of Nalgala, Wollombong that you mentioned too, and Southside Justice and Crime Reduction Victoria. You know, these models of care are alive and in action, and they stand to benefit everyone.
Thank you so much for that, Zoe. Sorry, I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we do have another interview that we have to get to before the end of our show. So I'm so sorry to interrupt you there. It just goes to show that there's so much to talk about when we talk about alternative first responders and how important they are to our community. So, yes, I'm so sorry to have to cut you up, but we are going to have to end our conversation there.
No worries. Thank you so much, Bong. I really enjoyed discussing that with you and look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much for that, Zoe. So we've been speaking to Zoe Ademar, who is working on the National Justice Project for Alternative First Responders campaign. To access letter writing resources mentioned in the conversation, head to our show notes after this program. We'll be back with the next segment in just a moment.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us.
We're now joined by Casey, an organizer with Students Against War, who, together with the Anti-Militarism Action Network, or AMAN, in a broad coalition with various groups and other organizations, will be having a close Pine Gap rally this Saturday on July 4th outside the Defence Plaza at 1:30 p.m. Casey is an activist with Students Against War, which is active at the University of Melbourne. She has been campaigning against her university's ties to Israel over the past 3 years, playing a central role in the Gaza Solidarity Encampment and 10-day sit-in of the main arts building at the University of Melbourne in 2024. She's also a member of Solidarity, a socialist organization active in NAM and around the continent. Good morning, Casey, and welcome to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No, it's so good to hear from you. So to jump right in, obviously last week we spoke to Alina from AMAN about Pine Gap and the convergence. But prior to that, there will be a rally this Saturday outside the Defence Plaza. Could you tell us more about this rally and why it's been called?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the rally will be at the Defence Plaza, which is a big 10-storey building on Bourke Street near Southern Cross Station, which is also an administrative hub for the Department of Defence. And I think the convergence on Pine Gap is a really important opportunity to develop something that we need much more of, which is opposition to Australia's ties to Israel, as well as the US war machine, which under Donald Trump, I think it's become increasingly clear, is about ensuring unrivaled US domination.
Exactly.
And that there's absolutely no limit to the brutality that they are willing to inflict to ensure this, as both the genocide in Gaza as well as the wars on Iran and Trump's attacks on Venezuela and Cuba as well have shown so clearly. So I think the convergence is incredibly important because of the element of pine gap and actually highlighting Australia's relationship and actually building more opposition to this. But I think as important as the convergence is, it won't be what will happen over the 3 days in Alice Springs, but really how much the convergence can actually enliven and encourage more opposition in all of the towns and cities across going forward that will make all the difference in terms of actually building a movement that can challenge Australia's ties to Israel and the US. So I think the rally is a really important step in beginning to build that here and now.
Absolutely beautiful. And obviously we did talk about it a little bit last week, but just, you know, in case listeners weren't listening in last week, could you explain just a little bit about Pine Gap and why that has become the focus for this convergence?
Yeah, totally. So I think if your listeners would have heard last week, Pine Gap is a joint US-Australian spy base on Arena in the Northern Territory, and it's one of the most important intelligence facilities in the world. So it using satellites, Pine Gap can track the phone signals, emails and internet activity as well as military communications across the Middle East. And that intelligence is passed directly to US military commanders and drone operators to identify and strike targets.
Yeah.
And Pine Gap has played a role like supporting every major US-led war. And we know played a role in the genocide in Gaza as well.
Yeah, exactly.
We've had a former employee at Pine Gap, Deb Rosenberg, who's come out to say that the facility is monitoring Gaza and collecting intelligence, which is assessed as useful to Israel.
Wow.
And we've also had defense experts come out and say that Pine Gap has almost certainly been used in the attacks on Iran as well. So I think Pine Gap is a really central way that we can see how Australia is providing support to these brutal US-led wars as well as Israel's genocide.
So the protests this Saturday specifically is calling for, you know, this sacred land back, an end to that so-called alliance with the US and cutting ties with Israel. I mean it goes without saying, but I'm just going to ask you anyway, do you see these demands as interconnected and how so?
Absolutely. I think first of all, like, the fact that we have a US spy base built on sacred country in the Northern Territory, which has apartheid laws for Indigenous people as a legacy of the Northern Territory intervention, says everything about the kind of politics and the kind of country that Australia is. I think in terms of unpacking the connections between the demands a little bit, I think it's really important to see how central the US alliance is here.
Yeah.
I think one point I'd really make is that I think people often talk about Pine Gap as if it is just a US base. But it is equally staffed with US and Australian personnel. I think just like a lot of the kind of deal making that Australia does with the US, I think it's really important to see that Australia is very much not just doing the US's bidding and following blindly what they want to do. They're very, very invested.
Active, exactly.
Because they see it as important in actually ensuring US support for what Australia wants to do in terms of its military missions in the South Pacific. And that's always been the dynamic. I think you can see Australia was established on the basis of genocide of First Nations people here as a settler colony. But it's always looked outwards at the Asia Pacific as a place it can dominate at the expense of other major powers in the region. And it's always needed a much bigger imperialist power to come and help it do that. So obviously that was the British, you know, when it was first established. And, you know, for example, in World War One, you had at the same time as you had Australian soldiers going all the way to Palestine, committing massacre, support of entrenching British dominance over the region. At the same time, they're using the opportunity of the war to seize New Guinea and pull Britain into supporting their own conquest in the region. So that together as well was is explicitly argued as defending white Australia on home, at home, on lands that they just stole through genocide. So the connections are still very much the same. Like, I think it's important to see Australia's racist to its core. It's a colony. It wants to defend its exclusive rights to indigenous land. It continues that enormous dispossession to this day. And that racism continues to be important in terms of justifying its warmongering abroad as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So absolutely. I think that they really go together. But
yeah.
I don't think it's so much that Australia supports Israel because Israel's a settler colony, Australia's a settler colony.
Mm.
I think it's more that Australia sees an opportunity in Israel, just like with, you know, Trump's war on Iran or the other US-led wars, that it's basically an opportunity to prove its relevance to what the US is doing.
The interest,
so that they can support what Australia's dominance over the region here.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think because of that, undoubtedly, like, you can't talk about cutting ties with Israel without talking about the US alliance and the relationship with the US. You can't talk about fighting the imperialism without challenging, you know, the racism and the struggle for land rights and self-determination.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly.
As well.
Yeah, so absolutely interconnected, that's right. Yeah, unfortunately, I have to wrap it up, but obviously, one last question, because it's not just a close by and get rally at the Defense Plaza this Saturday. There's also another anti-US imperialism rally that's been called by the LastNet community, and there's a counter-protest called by the Transaction Network and the Transqueer Solidarity. Could you just share with us a bit about that, and of course, the relationship between these protests?
Totally. So we're very much hoping July 4 can be a day of resistance for imperialism. The rally that is called at 12 p.m. at the State Library is a rally against U.S. imperialism, and particularly, you know, highlighting the brutal treatment that Trump of Cuba and Venezuela under Trump.
Yeah.
And so we're in absolute solidarity with that, and the rallies will link up together, marching to the Defense Plaza at 1:30. But we felt it was important to have a rally specifically raising Pine Gap, both because of the convergence and because of the urgent need to draw out more opposition to Australia's ties to Israel as well.
Yeah.
And yes, the Transaction Network is also calling a counter-protest to a rally organized by trans-exclusionary radical feminists at a time when the anti-trans politics is increasingly becoming mainstream alongside a massive attack on women's rights. So we're absolutely in solidarity with the counter-protest as well, which will also be at 12 p.m. And in building more opposition to the wave of transphobia and sexism.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Casey. I mean, obviously, we can talk so much more about this, and I would love to have you back on the show in the future. But for now, thank you so much, and see you on Saturday.
Thank you so much.
See ya. We've been speaking to Casey, an activist with Student Against War at University of Melbourne, and she shared with us the upcoming anti-military convergence coming up in mid-July, as well as the Close Pine Gap rally happening this Saturday at 1:30 p.m. outside the Defence Plaza.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on this Saturday, but there are some other events happening this week as well. So tonight there is an event, a public forum called Resisting One Nation, Building a Movement Against the Right, with speakers such as Giselle Hanna, who's the State Secretary of CPSU Victoria, Sue Bolton, Deepak Joshi as well. It's the forum starts at 6:30, but if you're attending in person, there's dinner from 6 p.m. That's at the Resistance Centre on Swanston Street, but you can also join online with Zoom. This is co-hosted by the Socialist Alliance Melbourne and Green Left, so you can go on their website greenleft.org.au for more details. I think there are some other events happening as well.
This Friday at the Retreat Hotel in Brunswick, there will be a relief concert for Venezuela. Doors open at 7 p.m. And this Saturday is our 50th
our birthday.
Yeah, we are having a party.
Oh, I think I said 9:30. It's 11. Is it 11 to 4?
Yeah.
If you're available to
it's
come
free.
To the town hall.
It's free for everyone.
Yeah, there'll be heaps of things.
It's very family friendly. There are heaps of stall food, activities. So please do come down. And of course, as mentioned earlier, 1:30, there is a Close Pine Gap rally at the Defense Plaza. At 12 p.m. at the State Library is the anti-imperialism rally called by last night. And at 12 or maybe 11:30, depends on when the terrorist decides to show up at Parliament, we will have a counter-protest against that as well.
And so just a very rapid-fire rundown on what we had on today's show. We started off with an excerpt from Acting Up with reflections on the COVID-19 pandemic.
And then we had an interview with Joe from the Wilderness Society about forest protection at 7:30.
And then at 7:45, we played an excerpt from Women on the Line in which they spoke to Mais, a women's rights organiser from the West Bank.
And at 8 o'clock, we spoke to Zoe about alternative first responders.
And finished up at 8:15 with an interview with Casey about the Close Pine Gap rally happening this Saturday.
Stay tuned because up next we've got Accent of Women and we'll see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.